This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Dose.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. And this is the trial of the week. We review a landmark article in critical care and emergency medicine history. And this is a fun one because the April trial of the week, one of the pre-planned ones was the SOAP 2 trial. Now, as it gets released, I'm on a little bit of a trip. Now, I say that because recording this before, we're calling our shot. I think this is going to get released on Tuesday as SOAP 2 is the national champion in the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness bracket. But if not, you could be listening and this would be the ultimate freezing cold take. But very, very lucky to be joined by Jessica Casey, incredible cardiology pharmacist, to go into the SOAP 2 trial, aka the comparison of dopamine and norepinephrine in the treatment of shock. So we set the scene. We talk about some receptor physiology of catecholamines, talk about the SOAP trial, recommendations for vasopressors, and those early surviving sepsis campaign guidelines. We go into the trial of the week, and then we talk about, we kind of dive in, did all forms of shock help or hurt, comparing mortality rates to this and other studies, what made your jaw drop in the supplementary appendix, some interesting trial facts, and then of course, where are we now, and is dopamine dead, and is norepinephrine a first line and the king? So we shall see. I predict yes, obviously, releasing it, but we shall see. Thanks again to everyone for participating in the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness Bracket. A great time. I think it's fun when we can talk about trials in kind of a unique way. And I think we were able to do that and have some fun talking about this. So thank you to everyone. What an awesome time. But let's get with our hopeful national champion April trial of the week, the SOAP 2 trial, starting right now.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're very lucky to be joined by Jessica Casey. And Jessica is a cardiology clinical pharmacist previously practicing in Kansas City, completed her post-residency training at Duke University Hospital. Don't worry, we've talked through my thoughts with Duke. She's okay with it. She still agreed to come on the podcast. And you can find her on Twitter or X at JMC_CardsFarmD. Jessica, welcome. Thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Nick. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And we, you know, you did your training at Duke, but that is not the team you're rooting for, right? This is March Madness season. So who's your college basketball team that you, what colors do you bleed?
I bleed crimson and blue. I'm a Jayhawk fan. I graduated from the University of Kansas. So, and I was born and raised a Jayhawk fan. So a Jayhawk fan I will always be. We're unfortunately not in the tournament anymore, but yes, I'm definitely a KU fan, more so than a Duke fan.
None of us are feeling sympathy for Kansas basketball fans. I just got to say, y'all have had some great runs, but we love that. Pro Kansas, definitely. Now, stay tuned to the end because, of course, We got to get Jessica's Kansas City barbecue recommendations, but let's start off focusing on our trial of the week and a front runner for the champion in the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness bracket, the sepsis occurrence in acutely ill patients, the SOAP 2 study. So, Jessica, as we set the scene and talk about the background, and we go through, we're going to talk about catecholamine vasopressors and their use in septic shock. But I think something that might be helpful is to review that receptor physiology of our big three, dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. And we think about those three, how do they differ in that respect?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's good to kind of lay the foundation, because it certainly plays a role in what we're going to be talking about with the SOAP 2 trials. So to start with norepinephrine, it exerts its effects on both alpha and beta receptors. We were speaking specifically about alpha 1 agonism that norepinephrine can affect. That's a G protein coupled process that stimulates the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, causes vasoconstriction in our periphery. When you look at more of the beta agonism effects, and this is kind of related to both beta 1 and beta 2, but beta 1 is a calcium mediated process that really promotes the actin and myosin binding to troponin C to increase contractility. We'll also see, in addition to the increase in contractility, an increase in chronotropy or an increase in heart rate as well. With respect to beta 2, norepinephrine does agonize those receptors as well, or does stimulate those receptors. And really what that affects is when beta 2 receptors are stimulated, that promotes calcium uptake into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that results in peripheral vasodilation. For epinephrine, it's very similar to the mechanism of action and receptor stimulation that we see with norepinephrine, but with epinephrine, we see more beta stimulation effects compared to norepinephrine. So still getting that mix of alpha and beta, just seeing a little bit more of the beta activity with epinephrine as compared to norepinephrine. And then lastly, dopamine, which is one of the biggest medications that we're going to be talking about today with the SOAP 2 trial. You can see both alpha and beta agonism with dopamine, but now we're bringing in the dopamine receptor agonism as well. So we've already talked about alpha and beta stimulation, but then dopamine agonism affects a couple of subtype receptors for dopamine. So dopamine receptor subtype 1 is located sort of all over. It's located in the coronary, renal, mesenteric, and cerebral artery beds. Dopamine receptor subtype 2 is located in the peripheral vasculature and the renal systems. So with those receptors being stimulated or agonized, you'll see resulting vasodilation and increased perfusion within those areas that we've talked about. Also, with dopamine subtype receptor 2, whenever those receptors are stimulated, we'll see an increase in direct natriuretic effects as well. There is also some thought that with dopamine agonism, you see an inhibition of prolactin and growth hormone via its effects on the pituitary gland. There also may be some implications in terms of immunosuppression by activity on this site as well. That's a lot for dopamine. I mean, it's a lot of different receptors. Well, but
you can tell why they wanted to look into that. All those different nuances, right? Like the norepinephrine, epinephrine, similar, but dopamine, you could kind of talk about all different sorts of things we thought it could influence.
Absolutely. Yeah. And while we'll really be focusing on the hemodynamic properties when we talk about SOAP 2, when you kind of pull back the aperture a little bit or open that up, you start to see effects that maybe you don't think would necessarily play into a trial about septic shock, but may actually have a role kind of down the line or maybe indirectly. So it is sort of fascinating to think about it from a mechanistic standpoint.
I love that photography reference. I only know that as I'm trying to learn photography. I'm like truly taking like an intro class now. So dropping the aperture reference, so cool. Very clear in my mind. Other than from just a curiosity perspective of all the different things it could do, what kind of characteristics from a kind of vasoactive vasopressor perspective made dopamine an appealing first line agent?
Yeah, I refer to dopamine sometimes, and I think a lot of other people do as well, as sort of this quote unquote inopressor. So it has these ideal properties with its beta agonism and alpha agonism effects to not only help with contractility, which is where the inotrope piece comes in, but also the vasopressor activity with the alpha agonism and resultant vasoconstriction. So it's sort of a one-stop shop, if you will. It's a, you know, one agent to provide both blood pressure support and cardiac output support, which is helpful in shock where hypoperfusion is such a characteristic definition of shock. And there's also these beneficial renal effects. We said the dopamine receptors are located throughout the renal vasculature, can provide those direct natriuretic effects, although that could be a whole nother podcast about renal dose dopamine. That's certainly been disproven. But you do get, you know, perfusion in your end organs, theoretically, by the location of these dopamine receptors. And so with all of that combined, that really makes dopamine, historically, that was really what made dopamine such a beneficial option to go to in a shock state.
And I think along with that idea, we also had reservations with norepinephrine use. So why were we scared? What properties made us nervous about using norepinephrine?
I think the predominant concern that we had with norepinephrine really is tied back to, once again, the mechanism. So it does provide a significant amount of alpha agonism and hence resultant vasoconstriction. So the worry was always, if we have so much alpha activity, so much vasoconstriction from norepinephrine, what is that going to look like in terms of digital ischemia for our extremities? What is that going to happen, or what is that going to affect in terms of reduced blood flow potentially to our end organs and cause more damage than harm? And so I think that was always really the big concern that was in the back of everyone's minds with norepinephrine and made people afraid to go down that route to use it for shock.
Yeah, when we were kind of going back and preparing for this, it's kind of funny when you look through the literature up to this, because, you know, there was a French observational study that even showed reduced mortality very early. But I think everyone said, okay, it's observational and, you know, kind of more of a theoretical concern. And when you have a phrase like leave a fed, leave them dead, that's just going to be right in the forefront of your mind. And I feel like that nickname probably, we got to look at the background of that. I wonder if that's dopamine driven or not, because that is a phrase when you have something like that, it makes people nervous. Now, I think most of us, and we'll get into what the guidelines recommend now, but in those early iterations of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines, was a specific vasopressor recommended as first-line treatment?
Actually, there was not a strong recommendation within the early iterations of the Surviving Sepsis guidelines. If you look back to 2004 and to 2008, the two versions of the guideline that were out before SOAP 2 was published, both of those iterations of the guideline say that either norepinephrine or dopamine could be considered first line in septic shock. And so they really left it to the discretion of each clinician to decide which one of those to use. So there was not preference given to one over the other.
And of course, this is SOAP 2, right? So we got the sequel. So of course, that means we probably had the original pilot SOAP trial. So tell us a little bit more and kind of give us an overview of what the initial SOAP study found.
Yeah, so the SOAP trial, the OG SOAP trial was published in 2006. And so as we already talked about, the earliest iterations of the sepsis guidelines really didn't give preference to dopamine or norepinephrine. So SOAP was a prospective multicenter observational study looking at patients in ICUs for a very short period of time, for a two-week window back in 2002. And when I say multicenter, these were all critical care units in and throughout Europe. So in this observational trial, they had just over 3,000 patients that were included. About a third of these patients were actually diagnosed with shock, which is about 15% of the total included in the population, and about half of the entire shock population had septic shock. And interestingly, in the SOAP trial, and once again, these are all European critical care centers, there was already a significant amount of norepinephrine being used. So up to 80% of patients in this trial were exposed to norepinephrine. Dopamine use was roughly around 35%. If you if you break it down to even single agent, so where only one presser was used, norepinephrine use was about 32% to, compared to about 9% for dopamine. So already seeing a lot of norepinephrine use even before SOAP2 was out. What they found in this observational trial, they looked at dopamine versus no dopamine. So patients who were exposed to dopamine versus no exposure to dopamine whatsoever, they are well matched between things like age, SOFA score, what have you. But they did find that the dopamine group actually did have higher ICU mortality, somewhere between like 43% versus 36% to those patients who had never been exposed to dopamine as a presser in this trial. Dopamine group also had higher hospital mortality as well, and reduced 30-day survival. So, even though it was a very short trial, 2 weeks long, there wasn't a standardization in care. So, across, these ICUs, so there was a lot in terms of treatment outside of shock, outside of the presser use that was sort of left to the clinician's discretion. We did start to see, where maybe there was a potential signal for increased mortality with the dopamine group compared to these other pressors, including and specifically norepinephrine.
And like you said, there are some, limitations to why this observational study wouldn't have, this was the initial one, right? Why this wouldn't have necessarily been the practice changer itself. And then kind of a lesser known study comparing these two vasopressors was published around the same time actually as SOAP2. And I agree with what your thoughts are. I think it highlights that we're actually using more epinephrine in the US at this time. And researchers kind of coming out to support its use. I think we may look back and say, oh, I'm not sure how much we were using. And I think some of this research is showing, you say 80% there, and we'll get into this one here, a lot of use. So published in Shock, first author, friend of the pod, Gaurang Patel, and it's entitled The Efficacy and Safety of Dopamine versus Norepinephrine in the Management of Septic Shock. So 252 patients prospectively randomized to treatment with either dopamine or norepinephrine. No change in 28-day mortality, higher rate of sinus tachycardia and arrhythmias with dopamine use. So equally effective with an increased risk of adverse effects. Remember that phrase, listeners. We're going to come back to that. All right, now let's get into the reason that we are here today, the trial of the week, right? The comparison of dopamine and norepinephrine in the treatment of shock, aka the SOAP2 trial. So, New England Journal of Medicine study published in March 2010, so international multi-center double-blind randomized clinical trial. So, adult patients requiring a vasopressor for treatment of shock were included. So a MAP less than 70 or a systolic less than 100, despite at least 1 liter of crystalloid and having clinical signs of tissue hypoperfusion. The key exclusion criteria were those who were receiving vasopressor treatment already for more than 4 hours pre-enrollment, or they had a serious arrhythmia or concern for arrhythmias, meaning they wouldn't want to put them in a trial that could increase that risk. So eligible patients were enrolled in 8 centers in Belgium, Austria, and Spain from December 2003 through October 2007. So patients were randomized to dopamine or norepinephrine. So norepinephrine was titrated up to 0.19 mics per kilo per minute, or dopamine was titrated up to 20 mics per kilo per minute. Target blood pressure determined by that attending physician. If the patient was hypotensive despite maxing out the study drug, open label norepinephrine was used. No open label dopamine use was allowed, and inotropes could be used to increase cardiac output. 28-day all-cause mortality was the primary outcome. And when they kind of designed the study, they found that they needed 1,530 patients, that pre-specified sample size to find a 15% reduction in 28-day mortality. So, Jessica, talk about the results, what patients were included, and maybe highlight anything I may have missed from a methodologic perspective.
When the trial was stopped, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, but at the time the trial was stopped, there were 1,679 patients enrolled. So 858 patients had been randomized to dopamine, 821 patients had been randomized to the norepinephrine arm. And they did have data out to 28 days, so to look at that 28-day mortality, that was available for about 97% of the patients. So the majority of patients were able to have data collected out to 28 days. Looking at some of the baseline, some of these things I don't think are super surprising. Looking at kind of our general population, the median age was around 67, 68, about between 55 to 60% male subjects. Median Apache 2 score was 20, median SOFA score was 9. Looking at the breakdown, this was an all-comers shock trial, so various types of shock patients could be enrolled into the trial. Looking at the breakdown, about 60% of the patients had septic shock, between 16 and 17% had cardiogenic shock, that same 15 to 16% were hypovolemic shock, and most of the hypovolemic shock patients were hemorrhagic shock patients. And then other types of shock were around 5 to 6%, and these included things like intoxication-related shock, spinal shock, anaphylactic shock, so a whole host of miscellaneous shock states included in that 5 to 6%. In terms of baseline hemodynamics, the mean MAP was about just under 60 millimeters of mercury in both arms, so 58 millimeters of mercury. CVP was 13 in both arms. There were some significantly higher wedge pressures in the norepinephrine arm compared to the dopamine arm, and significantly lower cardiac index or cardiac output in the norepinephrine arm as well. I'm not sure how clinically significant those are, but they might be when we kind of talk about the results. But just to keep in mind, those were some hemodynamic parameters that were considered statistically significantly different between the norepinephrine and the dopamine arms. Median lactate is about 2 in both arms. Most of the patients, 70%, were on mechanical ventilation, and renal function was similar at baseline between the two arms. Looking at open label norepinephrine use, as we said, this was allowed if if they were randomized, for example, to norepinephrine and maxed out at the pre-specified max for either norepinephrine or dopamine in the beginning, they could have open label norepinephrine in either arm. So about 18% of dopamine patients did require open label norepinephrine, compared to 13% of patients in the norepinephrine arm. And the average dose for that was recorded around 0.5 mics per kilo per minute. Epi and vasopressin use were similar in both arms. I do find it interesting to note, if you look at the baseline characteristics, there was an incredibly low rate, for at least for us now today in practice, there was an incredibly low rate of vasopressin use. There were only 4 total patients in the entire study that had vasopressin, which is just an interesting fact to me to look at now today and how we practice. Dobutamine use, so in terms of inotropic support, that was statistically significantly higher in the norepinephrine group compared to dopamine. But after 12 hours, higher doses of dobutamine were used in the dopamine group. So something to think about there. Steroid use was very similar between the two groups. And then another fact that was a little bit wild to me as well, going back, thinking about the vasopressin use and how low that was the amount of fluid given and the fluid balance for these patients. So between the two groups, they were similar, but just to throw out some numbers, there were the fluid given within the first 24 hours was around 4,000 to 4,500 mils. And fluid balance at 24 hours was net positive 2,000 to 2,500 mils. So once again, thinking about then versus how we practice today, markedly different. Looking at the outcomes, I did say the trial was stopped early. So they did have a pre-specified boundary for when to stop the trial, and that was crossed after the analysis of the first 1,600 patients. And so once that pre-specified boundary was reached, the trial was stopped. And at that point, 28-day mortality was calculated. It was not statistically significantly different between the two arms of the trial. So 28-day mortality was about 53% in the dopamine trial compared to 48.5%, 49% in the norepi trial, and that was not statistically significant. There also weren't any significant differences with respect to ICU and hospital mortality, nor mortality at 6 months or 1 year. So no difference in mortality from what we can see between these two groups so far. But looking at the adverse events, this is where we really start to get into some interesting information. There were more support free days of trial presser and open label presser in the norepinephrine group compared to dopamine. Hospital and ICU lengths of stay were not different between the two groups. Heart rate was higher in the dopamine group, and this was statistically significantly higher compared to the norepinephrine group, at least for about the first 36 hours of the trial, if you look at the graphs. Leading into that, there was a statistically significantly higher rate of arrhythmias in the dopamine group compared to the norepinephrine group. So about 24% arrhythmias in the dopamine group compared to about 12% in the norepi group. Most of these were cases of atrial fibrillation. Although the actual number of ventricular arrhythmias was low, you had about two times the amount of ventricular tachycardia and VFib in the dopamine arm compared to the norepinephrine arm. So overall event rates were low for our ventricular arrhythmias, but those rates were higher in dopamine compared to norepi. And in fact, more patients in the dopamine group had to have the trial drug stopped due to arrhythmia, and that was about in 6% of patients with dopamine compared to just under 2% in the norepinephrine group. And then lastly, in terms of adverse effects, the concern that we had with norepinephrine was that we were worried about these vascular outcomes, these ischemic vascular outcomes. But what they found in the SOAP2 trial was that there wasn't a significant difference in vascular outcomes. So there wasn't an increase in digital ischemia or necrosis. There wasn't an increase in arterial occlusions with norepinephrine compared to dopamine. There weren't any significant differences between the two with respect to that outcome. They did have a pre-specified subgroup analysis where they did break down the different types of shock and look at dopamine versus norepinephrine from that perspective. And as a cardiology pharmacist, of course, this is the part where I star and circle and do all of that. But looking at the subgroup analyses, the 28-day mortality was significantly higher in the cardiogenic shock population with patients who had cardiogenic shock treated with dopamine compared to norepinephrine. They did not find a statistically significant difference with respect to other groups of shock or other types of shock looking at dopamine versus norepi. So looking at kind of to conclude that or wrap that all up, the authors really stated that some of the positives of their trial was that they did have in the SOAP2 trial maximum time of exposure to the treatment arms. So the treatment presser was weaned last if they were trying to titrate off of pressers. Whatever arm the patient was randomized to, that presser was titrated off last and then restarted first if there was a presser that needed to be resumed. I think that does kind of bring into question or is a little bit tricky. I don't know if that's necessarily how it happens in practice every time. So you could argue, I think it was a benefit of the trial because you really do want to try to see a difference, but does that happen every day in practice? I don't think that it does. The trial was stopped, as we said, it was stopped early after reaching this pre-specified boundary, but its power was still met. So I'm not sure that necessarily is the biggest limitation there, but it is something to note.
It's kind of rare when a trial gets stopped early and it still meets its pre-specified power. That's not a Venn diagram that typically overlaps. There's a lot to unpack there because this is a heavyweight trial. This is, if you said, hey, we have four trials you need to know in critical care, this would be on, I got to guess, almost 100% of people's lists. But there is a lot to get into there, right? And so,
yes.
First things first, this is the treatment of shock, but I think a lot of us think of this as a septic shock trial. Now, do you think including all forms of shock, do you think that helped or hurt the study or the findings from this study? Because I'm curious your argument, because I feel like you could make it both ways in terms of a perspective.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you could go either way. I do think a big argument as to why it helped was that there was such a large number of patients. So by including all types of shock, you could really increase the number of patients that you could enroll in the trial. I think also from that argument too, we talked about surviving sepsis guidelines and not really giving a clear cut what's a first-line presser that we should use. But I think So maybe, you know, we get to answer that question here. But I think this also maybe gives us a little bit of comfort and a little bit of safety saying, you know what, you're not causing increased harm if you choose norepinephrine as your first line presser. So I think there's that clarification, or you could make the argument that norepinephrine is okay to use, particularly in times of shock where maybe the patient rolls into the ED and you're not quite sure, you know, they're in shock, but you don't know what the etiology is, what type of shock they have, or maybe it's a mixed shock picture. And you could really say, hey, based on the results of the SOAP2 trial, I'm pretty safe to go ahead and pull that norepinephrine as a first line presser. I think on the flip side of that, you could say that it hurts the external validity a little bit, because as we kind of alluded to, you kind of talked about this, Nick, where every different type of shock state, if we kind of break it into, you know, three or four large buckets, septic shock, obstructive shock, cardiogenic shock, distributive shock, obstructive shock, cardiogenic shock, if you lump all of those, if you lump all those together, you're really not thinking about the pathophysiologic mechanisms of how those patients arrive at shock. And even within, for example, hypovolemic shock, we talked about the majority of these patients were hemorrhagic shock, but you could have hypovolemic shock to a different etiology that's treated completely differently than hemorrhagic shock. So I think, and of course, with this large of a trial, there's no way to control for all of that. You can't control for all of the various treatments that these patients and all of these various shock states present with. So, you know, for my cardiogenic shock people, the first question that I have is, okay, well, was it more like de novo cardiogenic shock? Did they come in with an acute myocardial infarction and now have brand new, you know, reduced ejection fraction, and now they're in shock because of the myocardial infarction? Or is this a chronic worsening of their chronic, you know, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction? And if it was due to an AMI, did they get PCI? If it's septic shock, did they get the appropriate type of antibiotic? You know, was there, you know, things like that? So I don't think we have to worry about fluid. So if they got the amount of fluid that they needed, probably more than they should have. But you know, things like that are questions that you have that within the SOAP2 trial, there was no way that they could really control for all of those variables. And it's certainly a big question around the trial.
This feels like they designed it almost pragmatically, right? Because essentially they wanted to include people that were hypotensive needing a presser. That's like the broad overview of who they were trying to do. And on one hand, I agree, they come into the ED, you know, we don't have a Swan Ganz to tell you all those nice specific things, right? But then on the flip side, like you mentioned, we treat those things differently. And this trial doesn't tell us how many of them had appropriate antibiotics if they were in septic shock. This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. So I'm curious your perspective with your cardiology focus and specialty. Is there a theory of maybe a mechanism or things as to why we saw the only benefit we saw was in cardiogenic shock, right? They didn't see a benefit in septic or other distributive forms. So why do we think that is? Do we have a theory, or do we know?
Yeah. I was trying to think about this, and that kind of goes back to the mechanism piece that we were talking about at the very beginning. And so, yeah, I sat with this for a little bit and kind of tried to think about why we would have seen a benefit here and we didn't necessarily see that corresponding benefit in other shock states. And a couple of things came back to mind, and it really circles back to hemodynamics. And then another question I had is about the doses used in this trial, particularly of dopamine. So kind of starting from the hemodynamic perspective, I think in your patients who have cardiogenic shock, their cardiac output slash cardiac index is more likely to be negatively affected early on in their shock process, maybe compared to some of the other shock states that we typically see. And circling back to those baseline characteristics, so I said, you know, the patients in the norepinephrine arm did have a statistically significantly lower average or mean cardiac index compared to those patients in the dopamine trial. And I said, I was kind of questioning whether that was clinically significant, and maybe it really was. Maybe that hit, maybe that's what we were seeing, that lower cardiac index, cardiac output. really being positively affected here, and that might have affected the results. They did kind of make a note in the sub-analyses and looking through some of the correspondence, the original correspondence to the SOAP2 trial, going back to that dopamine group having higher heart rates in the very beginning of the study. So that first 36 hours of treatment with dopamine, increase in heart rates. And you can see the Kaplan-Meier curves for mortality in cardiogenic shock patients separated sort of within that same time frame. So that leads sort of to that question. If we have patients who are in cardiogenic shock who already have a low cardiac output, and we have this increased heart rate with dopamine, particularly in that arm, are we seeing increased myocardial oxygen demand that may have, you know, caused a further drop in cardiac output and further worsened outcomes potentially? And if you go back to, you know, 60% of the patients being cardiogenic shock due to acute myocardial infarction, that drop in myocardial oxygen demand due to a higher heart rate really could have had a detrimental effect. So if you've got the majority of your patients who are coming in with cardiogenic shock due to myocardial infarction, that could be why we saw the benefit compared with norepinephrine compared to dopamine. The second piece, like I said, kind of relates back to the doses of dopamine used in the trial, which were standard doses that we all know and love and are used to. But that paired with looking back once again at the baseline characteristics where more open label norepinephrine was used in the dopamine arm compared to the norepinephrine arm, right? So you would have to sort of make that assumption. I don't know if that's a safe assumption to make, but you would have to make the assumption that the majority of those patients in the dopamine arm that did require open label norepinephrine did reach that 20 mics per kilo per minute max. And as we know, kind of looking at the dose ranges of dopamine, those higher rates of dopamine are associated with more alpha agonism compared to more beta activity, which you see sort of in the 5 to 10 mic per kilo per minute range of dopamine. So we don't actually have that data. At least I couldn't find where the average rate of dopamine sort of settled out amongst the groups. But if you think that most of your patients were sort of receiving those higher doses of dopamine, maybe led to more alpha agonism, maybe led to more vasoconstriction, then you're also probably looking at a corresponding increase in systemic and pulmonary vascular resistance, which we know for our cardiogenic shock patients, anytime we increase that afterload, they're probably going to have a corresponding drop in cardiac output, corresponding drop in contractility. And so if we have these higher, you know, dopamine rates, I think that could also have played into it as well. If you're seeing increases in afterload, that could detrimentally affect your cardiac output and be a reason why we saw better outcomes with norepinephrine compared to dopamine.
I love that you highlighted too. One of the things that I love to do when we're going back and looking at older trials is looking at the correspondence and the letters at the time, because the letters are essentially editorials. It's people that are commenting on something they would have liked to see, a criticism or limitation that maybe the authors didn't point out. So you can kind of get a feel for what the discussion was around this topic in this trial. It's at the bottom of the page. So I love that you highlight that. I just wanted to bring that up for just a second. That's why you're on. That's why you are the expert for the SOAP2 trial, because those are great theories and great ideas, right? Ultimately, we're not going to really, really know, but those are really good ideas that all make sense from not only the trial, but physiologically. Now, the other thing that stands out, let's talk about that mortality rate. When we look at patients and treatments, right, SOAP2 was published in 2010, kind of looked at our care, essentially 2004 through 2007. So how, kind of give us a little compare and contrast of our mortality rate in SOAP2 and some of those earlier sepsis studies versus maybe some of the percentages that we would see now.
Yeah, so I think, if you go back to even just the original SOAP trial, that mortality rate is not much different than what we saw in SOAP2. So SOAP2, the range was between 46 to 50%. In the original SOAP trial, mortality was about 47%. I think if you go back to and Rivers was the higher end of the range, and Rivers was about 46%. So all of those were very similar. But if you start getting earlier and earlier and earlier, you see those rates start to come down, sometimes by half or more. So I think, you know, Arise, Promise, those are all within like the 20 to 30% range. Clover's 15%. So much different mortality rates at, you know, in the 2009, 2010 range, or I guess SOAP was published in 2006. But it much markedly different rates in mortality compared to the trials we're talking about now, compared to what we see currently or today, or more modern sepsis practice, I would say.
So you highlighted it. There was one thing that my jaw literally dropped as I was going through and looking through the supplementary materials, and that was the fluid balance breakdown. Because you mentioned not only just the sheer amount that they got pre-enrollment or at baseline, but the supplementary materials show the fluids they got and the fluid balance for the first week. So how low did your jaw drop, and describe to the listeners what kind of fluid management strategies we had in 03 to 07?
Yeah. So I think I've already said, like, I'm a paper and pen kind of girl. So when I saw those numbers, there were three circles, two stars. I mean, it was wild. and that certainly could have played and impacted the results in general, in terms of, you know, in looking at the mortality rates that we see from SOAP and SOAP 2. I think, you know, compared to what we do now, I think the fluid and the fluid balance could certainly have played a role in that, you know, those mortality differences that we see.
Yeah, the fluid balance there's no negative on the y-axis. It only has positives because they were only fluid positive, and every single one is above 500. Takes like day four to get anywhere less than 1 liter positive, right? That's not even, and you look at fluid administration, our fluid stewards, it just earmuffs, don't look at supplementary figure four, panel G, because that's where we found this.
Ignore that.
But
ignore
a very, that. We got to highlight some differences and things that, of course, could influence. Now, it's a perfect lead in. We got to have some fun facts. So I want to highlight a few things that stood out to me. So it would appear as if these agents were dosed in mLs per hour. Now, I don't know if they did that for the blinding purposes, because there's a conversion table showing a mic per kilo per minute rate, how that would translate to mLs per hour. I'm curious. In episodes coming where it's highlighted that mLs per hour is a very common use in Europe. So unclear, but there's a good table describing those things. And then they show how long patients were receiving the trial drug. And shout out to the at least one person who is receiving that catecholamine vasopressor at day 28, 4 weeks. Bed problems were likely not as big of an issue then as they are now. Right. Open label norepinephrine. All right, supplementary figure four. There were multiple times where it was used at rates above one. So that is the open label in addition to what they're getting. So we're looking at rates like 1.3, 1.5. So no infusion rate capping here. And a sign of the times, 20% of patients received activated protein C, aka Zygris, RIP. And then Jessica highlighted this fun fact. So VAST was published in February 2008. And in this study, only four patients received vasopressin. That is crazy. That also stood out to me. So whenever we kind of go these fun facts, it's like a trip back in time. Now, the other kind of trip back in time, I think some are probably shocked if they hadn't looked at this before. Mortality wasn't reduced in this trial. And this trial is the basis for how we use norepinephrine as kind of our first line pressor for almost everything, right? Especially if it's undifferentiated shock. So I think the real question is, kind of put your skeptic hat on now. And if this trial gets released, let's say at SECM in 2024, Do you think we've gotten on board as quickly with this SOAP 2 trial and the results as we did back in 2010?
That's such a good question. And part of me wants to say, no, I don't know that we would have jumped on board as soon. But I do think that the adverse effect profile certainly plays into that as well. That increased risk of tachyarrhythmias would, I think, make some people start to make that shift to norepinephrine. Would they have done it as quickly, or would we have seen the drop off in dopamine use as quickly today as we would have seen back then? I don't know. But I do think that risk of tachyarrhythmias did warrant some rethinking and how we kind of regarded both of those agents on the same level. I do also, you know, kind of going back to the lack of vaso use in this trial, you know, we would assume today we would have more vasopressin use. So maybe the outcome of the trial would have been completely different if we would have had some dopamine sparing, you know, vasopressin use. And maybe the outcome or the recommendation that we would see in the surviving sepsis guidelines would be similar to what we see, you know, in maybe not necessarily 2004 and 2008, but where dopamine is still given a little blurb about, hey, you could maybe consider using it. So, yeah, I don't know that we would have jumped on board as quickly, although I do think the adverse effect profile maybe would have gradually gotten more people over to the norepinephrine side eventually.
It feels like there would still be, because, you know, what you find is if medicine has a soft spot in your heart, you're going to allow some limitations in these things, right? We like norepinephrine, so sometimes you want the trial to do good. So I don't think it would be as universally loved, but I agree. There'd probably still be the same movement, but it's just funny to see how times have changed when we kind of go back. Now let's see kind of where are we now from this study. So we talked about early sepsis guideline iterations, surviving sepsis campaign, and this was when they were kind of doing every 4 years. So right, you kind of talked about what they recommended in 04 and 08. This was released, but published alongside the 2012 guidelines was a 2012 meta-analysis. And this was really kind of like the hammer down, right? The first was the alley-oop, this was the dunk. So what did this meta-analysis published in Critical Care Medicine ultimately find kind of comparing dopamine for norepinephrine and septic shock?
Yeah, that meta-analysis looked at 11 trials, 5 observational, 6 of them randomized in just over 2,700 patients. And of course, at this point, the largest randomized trial that was included in this meta-analysis was, in fact, SOAP 2. Looking first at the observational trials that were included within the meta-analysis, they did find significant heterogeneity. But when they looked at all 5 of those observational trials together, they did not see a difference in 28-day mortality, which is similar to what we saw with SOAP 2. But when they pulled out the one trial that they really pinpointed as being the source of this heterogeneity, they did find that dopamine was associated with an increased risk of mortality compared to norepinephrine. And then they looked separately at the randomized trials of 6 randomized trials. Once again, SOAP 2 was included in this group of 6. And they did find, once again, that dopamine was associated with an increased risk of mortality that was statistically significant. Out of all of these trials, only 2 assessed for arrhythmias, one of them being SOAP 2. And so they did indeed find that more arrhythmias were present in the dopamine arms compared to the norepinephrine arms. So with this meta-analysis, looking at these 5 observational, 6 randomized trials, they did find that this, you know, increased risk of mortality, increased risk of arrhythmias with dopamine. So all of that sort of led together to really kind of, like you said, slam dunk the point home that norepinephrine was sort of the path we were going down at this point.
So the meta-analysis, of course, on the back of the SOAP 2 trial, it led to what sort of recommendation? What did the 2012 guidelines for the Surviving Sepsis Campaign recommend for vasopressor treatment?
Yeah, so both in 2012, this was the first time we saw it, and then this recommendation was continued, I think, for 2016 as well. But in the first time in 2012, this is where we saw preference given to one vasopressor, and that pressor was norepinephrine. They did still leave dopamine in there as an alternative only in what they quoted kind of highly selective patient population. So those patients who are at low risk of tachyarrhythmia or for patients that had existing bradycardia along with their shock state. And that was a pretty low grade of recommendation. It was a 2C recommendation. But that was included for the first time in the 2012 surviving sepsis guidelines, where norepi was sort of elevated above dopamine.
So since these two, have we really had any other research, kind of doesn't have to even be high quality, just anything looking into these two vasopressors and comparing their use in septic shock or even shock in general?
I couldn't really find anything for septic shock in the way of septic shock, but I did find some within cardiogenic shock where I think maybe there's still this vestige of, hey, why doesn't this thing that's both an inotrope and a vasopressor work in this population? So there have been a couple of things that have come out recently. They're not like you said, they're not super high quality. But there was a 2017 meta-analysis, and this was mostly an Asian and African population of cardiogenic shock patients. They did find that there was lower mortality with norepinephrine compared to dopamine within this meta-analysis. And as we've seen, the kind of the common theme, a lower risk of arrhythmias with norepinephrine compared to dopamine. There was also a retrospective review published in 2022, and this was 520 cardiogenic shock patients. They did kind of admit that looking at the patient populations, the norepinephrine group of cardiogenic shock patients was more sick at baseline compared to the dopamine group. But they did find that there was a less need for additional pressor in the norepinephrine group compared to dopamine, but they did not find a significant difference in mortality between the two groups. And this was not 28-day mortality. This was in-hospital mortality between the two. So there are some little things out there here and there for cardiogenic shock, but there wasn't much in the way that I could find septic shock between these two agents.
So I think what I want to really know, anyone that's worked with me knows, I really don't like dopamine. If I see someone on it, and my number one goal is to try to get them off of it, find something different. So is dopamine dead?
I think so. For the treatment of shock, I should qualify that. I think so. Of course, in the cardiology world, and per, you know, if you're looking at like the ACLS bradycardia algorithms, of course dopamine is there, and of course we can use that for something like hemodynamically unstable bradycardia that's refractory to atropine. So I don't think the drug is dead overall, but I think for the treatment of shock, I think it's gone by the wayside.
And we got to end with this. Is anyone threatening norepinephrine's position at the top, or is this just going to be, is this our first line vasopressor? This is the Muhammad Ali of our catecholamines and just going to stand the test of time.
I think right now, and I think it's, you know, owing to the large or the broad inclusion criteria of SOAP 2, because it can be used so widely in a variety of shock states, I think it's first line for right now. And I can't really see anything waiting in the wings to sort of overtake that at this point. So thanks to SOAP 2, we kind of have that broad population, which we've already said is maybe a little bit of a drawback. But in here, in this case, in terms of crowning norepinephrine is the reigning first-line vasopressor, I think it helped.
So as teased in the beginning, we got anytime we have anyone from a well-known spot for a specific food, we have to have them come on and give some of their recommendations. Kansas City has been very well represented on the podcast. Jack Plenicky joined discussing the Champion Phoenix trial. He gave his recommendation. So share with us, where's your Kansas City barbecue spot that you're recommending to friends or visitors when they come?
Yeah. We were talking. I did listen to the Champion Phoenix episode with Jack, and he mentioned Joe's KC, which is great. But I think my recommendation would be Q39. That's where I would recommend people to go if they're ever in the Kansas City area and have a barbecue fix that they want to try out.
All right, bonus question. What's your ideal order?
Oh, I don't think you can ever go wrong with brisket. So brisket's probably the top. Sides? Oh, that's where it gets a little complicated. Yeah. But maybe mac and cheese. And as we're getting into like the warmer months, I don't, coleslaw sounds good for some reason as well. So
Can't hate coleslaw.
that's
Can't
what I'm
hate
gonna
good
go
coleslaw.
with.
It's one of those you'll never buy coleslaw. I won't buy coleslaw by itself, but anytime it's at a restaurant like that, it just feels like it's you gotta add it on. It's a test of how good the
Yeah.
place is. So if it's good coleslaw, then it's a pretty good spot, I think.
Yeah, I think you just need that crunch, I think, a little bit too. It's like a texture thing. You've kind of got the meat, got your like creamy mash, the mac and cheese, and then you've got like a little bit of crunch with the coleslaw. So I think it just balances it out a little bit.
Well, what a perfect ending talking about one of our favorite and most infamous studies in critical care and just medicine in general, the SOAP2 trial. So listeners, reach out to Jessica, let her know what an awesome job she did here joining us, sharing all this insight and knowledge at JMC underscore Cards Farm D. Jessica, thanks for joining. This was awesome. I had a blast. Appreciate you coming on and sharing all of your talent and time with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. This was awesome. I had a great time. Yes, I really appreciated it and hope we can connect in the future. This is cool.
Absolutely. Another huge, huge thanks to Jessica. Definitely let her know how great that was at JMC underscore Cards Farm D. And then, of course, reach out to me at Pharmacy to Dose, TO2 Dose on the socials. Very curious. Always like hearing from you. Ideas, feedback, suggestions, thoughts, just saying hi, all the above. You could also send me an old-fashioned email, pharmacytodose@gmail.com. And then, of course, the reference list with the earlier trials and all the things that we talked about on this episode is going to be in that podcast episode description, as well as the website pharmacy2dose.com. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only, does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. Users or patients should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.